Hello, and welcome to the Degree of Freedom podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and today we're going to be joined by Peter Boal, professor of history at Harvard University and Harvard's new vice provost of advanced learning, which gives them responsibility over institutions like Harvard's Initiative for Learning and Teaching and, significantly for listeners to this discussion, HarvardX. If you look over the leadership of the major MOOC organizations, you start to see a pattern beyond many of them having appeared on this podcast. On the West Coast, you've got Sebastian Thrun, the computer scientist and engineer running Udacity, as well as Daphne Koller and Andrew Ng, the computer scientist and engineers who founded Coursera. And on this coast, the reins of edX were handed to Anant Agarwal, who teaches one of MIT's most popular engineering classes, and he works closely with Sanjay Sarma, MIT's director of digital learning, who is also professor of, you guessed it, engineering. Now, scientists and engineers at the helm have helped propel the MOOC movement through many a challenge. Just creating and implementing the technology needed to teach thousands of people simultaneously is a remarkable feat of systems development, and the culture of research and experimentation that is coming to define MOOCs owes a great deal to the laboratory culture from which many of these leaders emerged. And let's not forget that the first 100,000-person courses that put MOOCs on the map were taught by gifted instructors covering science and technology subjects that large segments of the public were clearly interested in learning. But as MOOCs branched out to where their catalogs more resemble those of a liberal arts college or university than an institute of technology, the outlook of these organizations also broadened. Which is why it was no accident that when Harvard decided to put someone in charge of their MOOC efforts, they chose a scholar whose technical interests had been put in the service of his primary goal, the teaching of history and culture. Peter Boal is the Charles H. Carswell Professor of East Asian Languages and Civilizations, who teaches Asian history and intellectual history, as well as technology-based methodologies such as GIS mapping that can enhance our understanding of other lands and other cultures. As I mentioned, Peter was recently named Harvard's Provost for Advances in Learning, and he, along with Professor Bill Kirby, teaches the recently released MOOC version of the popular Chinese history course, China X. Peter Boal, welcome to Degree of Freedom.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to focus on ChinaX in a moment, but first, can you describe to listeners how this new MOOC fits with your other classes and scholarship related to China studies?
The course itself, the ChinaX course, begins really from our basic undergraduate survey of Chinese history. And we had been making that available online through the Division of Continuing Education for a good number of years. And we had seen that although we were early on, we had used some digital material on the website, we really saw that this was an opportunity to do much more for the online students. And initially, our focus was on the students in the Division of Continuing Education. But when HarvardX came around, well, here are resources that will allow us to really do a good job, an extraordinary job, and at the same time, make it available to a much larger public. That's what we set out to do, and we began to think of all the sorts of things we'd like to do and to see if they would be possible.
And in addition to your teaching and research, you've been playing a major role in the integration of technology and education at Harvard. Can you talk about your work with geographic information systems and other technology initiatives?
That really goes back now, for me at least, for around 12 years, where I got involved in developing a geographic information system for Chinese history in collaboration with Fudan University in Shanghai, the fundamental administrative structure of China for a 2,000-year period from the unification in 221 BC. And that led me to see that Harvard had very weak support for geospatial technologies, which were really beginning to boom. And then the university asked me to bring together faculty from across the university to discuss what we should do. And out of that came the Center for Geographic Analysis, which brings together academic professionals who can help faculty and students both learn how to use geospatial technology and apply them in their research. In addition to that, I became involved in a project, the China Biographical Database Project, which is an online database of biographical data, relational database, an important aspect of it, for, again, all of Chinese history, looking at kinships, social relationships, careers of basically the political elite. And that had gotten me thinking more about the ways in which we can use online mechanisms for sharing information, but also introduced me then through computer scientists to new technologies for modeling texts, for mining information from texts, and so on.
Now, you were recently named Harvard's Vice Provost for Advances in Learning, which makes you responsible for both HarvardX and the Harvard Initiative for Learning and Teaching. Most listeners will be familiar with HarvardX, but can you tell us a little bit about, HILT it's pronounced?
Yes, HILT was created through a very generous gift from Gus and Rita Hauser, who wanted to support innovative teaching at Harvard, a gift to the president, and she then launched the Harvard Initiative in Learning and Teaching as a mechanism both for encouraging research and teaching, but also providing grant support to people who wanted to try new methods and develop new technologies in learning and teaching. That continues. HarvardX came afterwards, in fact. But I think that the HILT project did some very valuable things. It brought together people from around the country who are interested in data-driven research on how students learn and how we can better teach. And if you look at HarvardX, the way it's structured, it's very clear that it's been structured, the courses have been structured in such a way to take advantage of that research. A simple example is the problem of retention. We know that in a 50-minute lecture, students, unless they're assiduous in taking notes and reviewing their notes, students don't retain as much as we would like. Well, how do we handle that? One way you handle that is you break the lecture up into smaller segments, and students retain more. If they listen for a while, they respond, they do something, listen for a bit more, respond and do something. And that's how HarvardX courses work.
Getting back to ChinaX, one of the first things I and my fellow classmates couldn't help noticing was the complete course is actually 15 months long, which makes ChinaX more than five times bigger than the longest MOOC I've taken or ever heard of. Now, you've chosen to actually split your course into a series of mini courses, which is an innovative break from what we've gotten used to with most MOOCs. Can you talk about the decision-making process that went into busting the conventions of short or semester-long classes?
Well, it originally was a semester-long class. We had taught the course as 3 hours a week of lecture and 1 hour of discussion section with readings and papers every week. And we had originally assumed that we could do that in an online environment as well. But of course, you can't. And I think one of the important discoveries for all of us involved in online learning, particularly open online courses, is that people who are taking these courses are not students. They are people who have full-time careers, generally. And the amount of time they have to devote to anything is quite limited outside of their work. When we began to understand that, we saw that rather than trying to put out 4 hours of content a week, let's say, we would have to really limit the speed at which we made things available. And so we decided we'd only do one module a week. Our on-campus students were given minimum of 2 modules, but often 3 modules a week to work on, as well as extensive reading. But they're full-time students, so it's a different set of issues for the different kinds of publics.
And your in-class students are also using these modules, right? You sort of flip that classroom?
Right. So that's the flipped classroom or the inverted classroom, where rather than just going in and giving students lecture, they can watch the lecture in these new online format. They watch it before class. They do various kinds of assessments. And then when they come into class, they have 1 hour of discussion, not just a discussion of what they saw in the module, but discussion of readings, for example, of primary sources that fit with the modules they had watched.
And having started the online version of the class, I've seen the introduction of GIS in the class in week one and visiting lectures and museum locations in week two. So is ChinaX going to be kind of a showcase for some of the ideas you've been discussing with colleagues over the years? And if so, what else can we expect as ChinaX rolls along?
Our thinking of that is constantly evolving. To begin with, we decided that one of the things we would want to say to the public here, but also in China, was that if you already know Chinese history, particularly for the public in China, why would you be interested in this course? And the answer is because this will give you a chance to see how your country's history is taught in America. And for students outside of China who wanted to learn about China's history, it seemed to us that just having Bill Kirby and myself tell them was not as good as introducing them to the many faculty at Harvard who do research on China. And that, in fact, we could invite them in, not so much to give lectures as much as to interview them, to talk with them about their work as it fit in to the module for that week. And so I think our ultimate goal is basically to bring in every single one of Harvard's faculty who teaches on China and give them a role to play in the course. But there's another way we've thought about it as well. Our course goes from the Neolithic all the way into the present. And we cover literature at various moments, art, institutional history, politics, social structures, the economy. And every one of these things could be a course in itself. So what we've thought is that in some ways we've developed the roots and trunk of the tree, but all these branches could be built out. And eventually that our colleagues would have their own courses and the audience for ChinaX could be then invited into those other courses. I think we've started, rather than thinking in terms of full courses, I think our thinking has begun to shift a bit. And it's shifted towards modularization. And by that I mean that rather than asking faculty to make this extraordinary commitment of time and resources necessary to do a full course, whether it's an 8-week course or a 40-week course, doesn't matter, it's still a tremendous commitment of time. that what we want to encourage people to do is to create modules, a series, perhaps one, perhaps more, of short pieces, half an hour, 2 hours maybe, devoted to a particular subject or what might be called a learning element, a set of concepts, particular kind of problem, particular technique. And students could come in and they could choose from all these many modules, whether it's on Buddhism or popular religion, on politics of the Communist Party or the politics of the Qing government, the last imperial government. China X would be this big umbrella under which you could create many different courses by your own choosing, or we might in fact recommend different pathways. So if you're interested in literature and art, here are 8 modules that you might want to take, and we might then offer a certificate for those 8 modules. We're not sure about the certificate part of it, but certainly expanding the range of modules that we have, inviting faculty to do modules in their own area of expertise, strikes us as the most interesting way to go.
That's an interesting way to redefine MOOCs also.
Yes. And that really gets us towards, I think, what the larger issue with MOOCs is, that we've been very much devoted to thinking of them in terms of courses. And here I'm really speaking for myself rather than the university. We've thought of them as courses, we've treated them as courses, and yet, of course, they're not really courses in the university or college sense because we're not giving credit. We don't have face-to-face contact with individuals. We're doing something that's interesting and useful, but it's really not the same as a course. And yet we've really used the course format. But what happens if we say most of the people who come into one of these MOOCs are really there to look around? Some people do want to complete it all the way, and that's important. Gain recognition for that. But how about the 90% who register but don't necessarily want to get a certificate or don't necessarily want to complete it? Perhaps we're living in a world where people want to browse and put together their own sets of interests. And why not fit that? People will do what they want to do, not necessarily what we want them to do.
You mentioned students in China taking the course. Curious, do you have a large enrollment from China?
We have not so many, only around 3,000 people. There's a lot of press coverage of the course in China. It hasn't been blocked. There are a number of people in China or groups in China that have started to put translations of the lectures online. And so what we think may be going on is that people are downloading the lectures, doing translations, and then reissuing them. It's hard for us to keep track of the various possible uses.
And just returning to your role as vice provost for a minute, most MOOC students don't realize that one of the key motivators for colleges and universities to participate in the MOOC experiment is the opportunity it gives them to participate in educational research. I understand that every Harvard X course is associated with at least one research project. Can you talk about some of the research underway and some of the course data you've been gathering, what you hope to get from all this work?
We're trying to build a robust research program to understand both how to make a course better. Easy example is figure out which sorts of assessments lead to better understanding, which don't. What are the things that can be done to retain interest? Where do people come from? Demographics. I would have to say that it's been more difficult to get good data than we thought. So we're still really doing very preliminary sorts of things. We're not as far along as we had hoped to be. We're looking also carefully at classes at Harvard, which use online material in order to flip the classroom. Does this make a difference to the way students learn? Are they doing better than they were before? I think all these questions are really up in the air. Whether we can really translate what we learn into better teaching is something we're still working on.
Finally, one of the benefits MOOCs and other technology-based education initiatives seem to be promising is they bring together people from diverse communities within an institution to talk about teaching, especially new teaching opportunities within a university. Can you talk about some of the cultural changes you think these new technologies are bringing to places like Harvard?
I would say that one of the developments is a really great increase in the attention we're paying to teaching, not just to something that graduate students have to learn to be teaching fellows and run discussion sections, but which faculty have to think about too. And some parts of Harvard are extremely good at helping faculty develop as teachers. The Harvard Business School is an example of that. I think in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, which teaches the college students, we've been more focused on helping graduate students than we have on helping faculty improve the way they teach. I think there's great interest in having a better understanding of how students learn, the diverse ways in which students learn, and the relationship between certain kinds of courses and certain styles of teaching and styles of learning. That, I think, is happening, and we expect that as we build up the Harvard X team and production facilities, that, in fact, part of what we'll be doing with anybody who comes in to develop a module or a course is spending a lot of time with them on issues of pedagogy, how you teach.
Peter, I want to express my appreciation. Thank you so much for being on Degree of Freedom.
Jonathan, thank you for having me, and I look forward to listening to more of your programs.
That was Peter Boll, Harvard's Vice Provost for Advances in Learning and one of the professors behind Harvard's massive open online survey course, ChinaX. Early in that interview, I mentioned that some students for ChinaX were surprised to learn the course would go on for 15 months, although shocked would probably be a better word, especially for those of us who logged into our edX accounts and discovered the schedule on Halloween. But then I thought, why not tinker with timing in such a way? After all, one of the advantages when creating a MOOC is that you do not need to feel bound by a semester system developed to enable and standardize residential learning programs. So the notion that a quote-unquote real course must go a certain number of weeks is really just an artifact of earlier and different system. Now, most professors embracing liberation from the semester system are pulling in the other direction as ChinaX by creating shorter, usually 6 to 8 week courses versus semester-long classes that go on twice as long. These short courses often teach a subset of what a professor might include in a full semester class, the subset that interests the professor most, although some teachers succeed in fitting syllabus material meant to fill a semester into less time by just talking faster. But as you just heard, the 15-month modular format of ChinaX is an experiment to see if teaching everything at a more leisurely pace is yet another mode MOOC professors should consider. I just mentioned the word experiment, and it's a term that's come up quite a bit on the Degree of Freedom blog, especially given the proposed definition for a MOOC I've been flogging over the last month or two. With apologies to those who have read the case I've made for such a definition, using the very words I'm about to repeat out loud, trying to define MOOC in the most obvious way, by using the words that make up that acronym, doesn't really work. For each of those words, massive, open, etc., is either ambiguous or open to challenge. For example, at what point do you move from being really big to massive? 1,000 students? 10,000? 100,000? And are we talking about enrollees, active students, or course completers? And even if we ignore the debate over whether or not MOOCs represent genuine open learning resources and just define open as free of costs and other barriers to entry, do we really want to say that if Coursera, edX, or Udacity decided they had to add a $2 registration fee to survive financially, that this would immediately transform all their content from MOOCs into something else? I suppose online is relatively unambiguous. Well, even there, you can make the case that initiatives like Coursera's learning hubs are creating hybrid online-offline environments. But I would say that even the word course is up for grabs. For instance, if 1 million people download an iTunes lecture series, there's no disputing that's pretty massive, open, i.e. free and online, in which case it must be how we define the term course that would lead most people to say that listening to iTunes lectures represents something different than taking a MOOC on the same topic, or even the same course offered by the same professor delivered via Coursera or edX. I've written before about the perils of making such a distinction, so I'll repeat those arguments here, except to say that while MOOCs do tend to package together more of the material we associate with a course, it's not at all clear why we should reward one type of online learning with the title MOOC just because it includes a few multiple-choice tests alongside recorded lectures, especially if those tests are badly designed and don't cover course material adequately. In which case, perhaps we should just make things easier on ourselves and say that only courses from prestigious colleges and universities delivered via Udacity, Coursera, or edX get to be called MOOCs. But like the term massive, what threshold do we have for prestigious? And who gets to decide which colleges and universities should be considered in that club? Maybe we could just let the MOOC providers make all those choices, but even here the field is starting to crowd up with new entrants like FutureLearn and iVersity, not to mention Canvas and even Udemy forging their own partnerships and releasing their own products which they proudly call MOOCs. While pondering these matters, it struck me that the challenge to define MOOC was comparable to defining other vague terms such as bald, sharp, or beautiful. In other words, it's a philosophical issue. For example, the struggle to determine the threshold for massiveness is the same as trying to figure out how many hairs separate a bald person from a non-bald person, a challenge resulting from vague premises called the Sorites paradox, which I happen to learn in my first MOOC class if anyone's interested. In fact, the struggle to define MOOC I've been talking about derives from the fact that we're trying to come up with an empirical definition based on the observable and/or measurable characteristics of a course, components, requirements, enrollment numbers, etc., to see if it deserves the MOOC label or not. But what if we instead decided to separate MOOCs from non-MOOCs based on their purpose rather than their observable elements? In other words, we take a teleological versus an empirical approach to the problem. In that case, the challenge would be to find that unique something that MOOCs have been created to do that separates them from all other forms of online learning. Educating people won't cut it, given that this is the telos for all teaching, online and otherwise, and even educating lots of people for free doesn't provide enough distinction between a MOOC and every other form of free learning, including that aforementioned iTunes U example. But if you listen to the people who brought us the MOOC movement, the pioneers in early MOOC-type projects or the leaders of today's MOOC organizations, each one of them stresses that MOOCs are really an experiment in which each new massive online course serves as both an educational tool and a research project designed to see what works and what doesn't as we try to push the envelope with technology-supported education. So if all of our empirical attempts to define a MOOC are ending up in contradiction or absurdity, perhaps we should embrace a definition that puts purposeful educational research and experimentation at the heart of the MOOC project, and then take a look who gets to be or stay in the club and who has not yet paid the entrance fee. And with that, it's time to sign off. But as we get into the final month of this project, I'm going to try to return to weekly podcasting, which means I can happily invite you to join me in 7 days from now on the next Degree of Freedom podcast.